Thank you for downloading this podcast from policyreview.tv.
Thank you very much, and thank you for the invitation to be here, which is a very exciting opportunity. And I'm extremely sorry that I'm not able to stay for the full day, but unfortunately I already committed myself to speaking somewhere else. I started as director of the new Rees Centre for Research in Fostering and Education in April of this year. So bear with us. We don't have a great flurry of findings for you yet, but we are, we think, working in a rather different way to some of the ways in which traditional researchers have worked, and hopefully more closely with people involved in the services. And I'll say a bit more about that. The Rees Centre is funded by Core Assets, which some of you will know is an independent children's services provider in the UK and internationally. And it's a group of companies, one of which is Foster Care Associates. I believe there's somebody here from there if you want to know more about it. But it's a group of companies, and they were interested in furthering the information available, evidence-based information available, to inform children's services, in particular fostering services. And I want to make quite clear that although they do fund us, there is no way in which we are either privileging their services in the work that we do, or only there to inform their services. So in other words, it is a research centre about fostering, all fostering, independent and local authority, and we are not there to provide, if you like, the messages of any one organisation, but we are there to provide messages for anybody working in fostering and to listen to them, more importantly, about what the needs are. So the overall aim is to improve the life chances of children, young people in foster care. We're based in an education department. It's very easy to see that at the moment, for whatever reasons, and I think one of the things we need to do is to interrogate the reasons in the long run, children who are in care come out of school with a lot worse results. For example, on GCSEs in 2011, there was a 45% gap between the A star to Cs for between children who'd been in care and other children. On the other hand, David Berridge from Bristol has written about the fact that children do better in terms of educational outcomes the longer that they're in care. So it's of interesting issues here to interrogate and work out quite what's going on and how we can best help those children. We're doing this by really two main strands of work. One of them is to make better use of current research. One of the things that was said to me when the centre was set up by the funders is there's very little research on fostering. There's actually rather more than is available easily to folk like all of us in this room. For one thing, I can go on a university website and access all sorts of journals, and supposedly I'm given the time to read them, although that's not always the case. You, on the other hand, can't even access those journals in most cases, let alone have the time to read them. They are a confusing mass, which, unless you happen to have had a career in research, makes rather difficult reading, and even when you have had, in some cases, they're impenetrable, they're badly written, they're not, they're too long. And so if you're making a decision this afternoon about allocation of resources on fostering, they're not going to help you in many cases. You want to know what are the three key messages which I should be thinking about in making this decision. And therefore, we want to spend a lot of time and energy on synthesising and quality assuring research so that the people that need the information can use it. People in government, people like yourselves, people who are internationally scattered. And the second strand of work will then be to use those reviews of research to inform our future work. And the picture on the screen at the moment, that's our first review. I've got about 60 copies here. I'd be glad to get rid of them. And I certainly won't be taking them with me because I'm about to get on the plane. And there are plenty more available from the Rees Centre. If you don't get one today, you want 10 copies for other staff, just email in and we'll send them out. So a key second strand is to address the gaps revealed in that research. And I'm going to talk specifically about in a minute about the gaps in this that this review revealed and how we're trying to address them. So key principles for our work. The first one, which doesn't sit terribly comfortably with the government's current very strong emphasis on adoption. We do, of course, recognise that adoption and fostering are closely related and that there are many key issues in adoption, not least of which people keep telling me that parents who adopt receive relatively little support following the adoption, and therefore that's a key issue for them. We are not funded to look at adoption. I'm not ashamed of that. Robert has shown you the figures, and I believe that there is a huge issue with these very large numbers of children who are coming into care and the pressure to take yet more children into care, which easily justifies us focusing clearly on fostering. There are also other research groups like the Hadley Centre in Bristol who are doing an excellent job of looking at adoption, and there's a new centre starting at Sussex University where I came from, focusing exclusively on adoption. I don't need to do that and replicate what somebody else is doing. We want value for money. We're going to look at fostering. The second thing is, I come from a very strong background of trying to get more service providers and practitioners involved in using research. I don't think it's always possible to engage them in the research, though I'll tell you how we're trying to do that in a moment. But it is important to make sure that they can access the research and use it and actually talk to people about it if they want more information. And so I'm very committed to that. And that's, I think, probably why I was asked specifically to run this centre, because that's what I've tried to build up over the years in other areas, in social work and in education. Thirdly, we have a very strong commitment, as I said, to synthesising the current evidence to make better use of it. And in this review, because a review had already been published just previously, about March, April time, by the DfE, by McDermid et al. On recruitment and retention, which many of you will have seen, and the Fostering Network had done a very useful survey at that same around the same time, we, rather than focusing on the UK evidence, which had already been reviewed, we looked at what had been published in other countries. Now, as soon as you look at what's been published in other countries, it's obviously problematic. So, for example, in terms of its transferability to England, and I think probably we need to talk about England because although some of you are in Wales or maybe sometimes have worked in Scotland, of course, there are differences in the way the legislation operates and so on, which can sometimes get us into difficulty if we don't take account of that. But crucially, for example, in Spain, the majority of care is kinship care, and that makes their research, even if they don't specify in the paper, it might well be that most of the carers were kinship carers, and therefore there are some different factors operating. So we've had to look carefully at transferability, and we will try to make that explicit. But still, my guess is that you do want to know what the CASEY programmes are doing in the US to market and recruit foster carers, in some cases very successfully, because there are approaches in there that would work potentially in England. There are no specific cultural reasons why that particular approach might not be successful if it were tried. The next point is, and I'm sorry if this is a bit esoteric and researchy for some of you, but we do need research findings we can trust. And unfortunately, going out and interviewing three carers in, let's say, Shrewsbury, and then making generalisations on which to base national policy might not be quite strong enough. So we are very committed, and that was one of the reasons for this centre being in Oxford, where there are excellent researchers with very strong methods. We are very committed to finding out both what works, which I'm afraid means sometimes doing controlled trials or comparison groups, and how it works, which means coming and interviewing people to find out what they think and what the young people in care think and what the social workers think, and getting perspectives from different people in the system, not relying on one source. Because I've no doubt you have your own views about the biases in the system, but I'm quite sure you're well aware that if we ask different people about what works in fostering, we get somewhat different. What I mean by different people, people representing, if you like, different roles in the system, we would get different answers. We are also trying to be more creative, and at this point I have to declare that I think there's a bit of an age bias here. Luckily, I'm working with some younger people who are less terrified of mobile phones and what they can do and what I don't use on them, blogs, Twitters and all the rest, and are doing a great job of trying to engage the community. And our first blog was provided by Edward Timperson. We're absolutely delighted. We're already getting quite a few responses. We asked him to contribute a blog about the recent announcement about supporting people, care leavers, with a sum of money. And that's generated quite an interesting debate. So do have a look at that and do join in. OK. I think Robert's already rehearsed this extremely well. I don't have to go into much detail, but I would like to say it's an international problem. Australia, Canada, US, very much looking at the issue of how to deal with the number of children and young people coming into care increasing faster than the number of foster carers. And this is an American study, but they all say similar things. The exact numbers are a bit different. The second bullet point, regarding the number of people requesting information about fostering and how many of those, if you like, go through to registration and placement, does vary internationally, and it varies within countries in different studies. So I don't want to make too much of this, because the second study there is a UK study which noted that 80% of inquiries didn't result in application. But that study is nearly 13 years old, which means the data were probably collected 15 years ago. And I think the situation and the context is very different. And we probably, although it was a really good study, we shouldn't place too much on that right now for informing our practice. The other study is an Australian study, which is a very well-designed study. But when we start to interrogate the reasons why many people inquire and then don't carry on, you can see a very complex picture, and I'm going to come back to that. But this is the problem that we've been trying to address in our first review and our first study. So this review took the question, why do people not kinship fostering here? Why do people who are going for non-kinship fostering, why do they initially consider it? And what factors initially promote their progress into through the system? We're only talking about initially, and that was important because as people go through that system, their perspective of it changes. They find out more about it, and that's something which we're going to interrogate. In this review, this particular review, we looked at 32 studies from Australia, Canada, US and Scandinavia. They were retrospective, by which I mean they asked people why they initially came into fostering. With the exception of two studies, they were all looking backwards. Now, I don't know how many people in this room have fostered, but if you have been fostering or have in the past fostered for some time, and I ask you now to tell me what your motivation to something was, or anything else, by the way, changing jobs or moving house, 15 years ago, you would have quite a job giving me what you felt then, which hasn't been altered by hindsight of the experience of doing whatever it was. Yeah? So we have a problem with retrospective studies because they don't actually tell us what necessarily the person felt at the time. They're often very small scale. I've already made reference to this. And I've worked in government for 6 years advising, trying to advise the DfE on research strategy. And I have to say that it is impossible to make national strategy based on one very small study. However, strongly evidence, because you do have to think carefully about how representative it is and how it will work when it's rolled out to, how a particular intervention will work when it's rolled out to other areas. And I think there was some evidence in some of the studies, by no means all, that the foster carers interviewed thought that maybe the person interviewing them was going to have something to do with assessment, accountability, those kinds of processes, perhaps some of the bureaucracy that Robert referred to. And I think that's a problem. I think we have to be very careful to make it clear that the research is independent of the service provision if we're going to get good responses. And we're tackling that in a rather strange but hopefully original way, which we think might be more authentic. I'll talk about that in a moment. There was only one study out of those 32 in which carers played a significant role, and those carers were asked to comment on the original question and on the emerging findings. I can't understand how we can do research and not ask the carers, if that's what we're interested in, to help us to design the study, because you don't get a decent study as a researcher sitting in a university, or I'm afraid even as a policymaker sitting somewhere else in a service, if you don't know what people on the ground actually think the problem is. So I think we do have to have this closer relationship. We then compared the findings with the McDermott et al. Review, which was the one commissioned by the DfE, and with the Fostering Network survey. And the recommendations are being addressed from this study. I'll come on to them in a moment, both through our own study and through the DfE's currently commissioned survey of people in the general public about whether they've thought about fostering or adopting and what kind of characteristics they have. That's a survey going on at this point, at this moment in time, funded by the DfE. We've had meetings with them to make sure we complement and don't just duplicate. So the main findings were that the very initial motivation, I'm not saying other things aren't important, the very initial motivation often came about through contact with other, with existing foster carers or a fostered child. And that there were also some evidence, particularly from the States and Australia, that myths about fostering were very common and put people off. And the kind of myths, you probably know what they are. They're all bad, these children. They all end up going to prison. Unfortunately, more than should do end up going to prison. But nevertheless, it's nowhere near that kind of message. They all go to prison. They all really badly behave. They'll set fire to my house, all that kind of stuff. Or you've probably heard it all before. But the myths are important because they tell us something about public understanding. There are people in this room, Robert, Harvey, lots of people in this room, who are doing a huge amount to create better information about fostering. Fostering Fortnight, that you've already mentioned, we know does a lot on that, to promote a more positive image, to be more realistic but positive about what goes on. But nevertheless, if those myths are common in the public, then that's going to be a problem. And my background is in disability research, and that's an area where the myths are just extraordinary, and the Paralympics have done more to address that than any other effort that's ever happened. Suddenly people who just have no understanding of disability whatsoever have tackled it. So we somehow need a kind of Paralympics equivalent. I don't know what that is. We need to think about it. But it brings it to the public understanding in a way that has not happened before. And the third one, which I think is very pertinent to something which Robert referred to before, has to do with the kind of messages that potential carers get from existing carers. Robert mentioned specifically that a key issue for service providers is what happens when things get difficult. That's come through very strongly so far in my meetings with carers about what they want researched. And it's quite clear from the large-scale surveys that people hear stories about lack of support, that somebody didn't know what to do and it was the middle of the night or the weekend and they couldn't get any help and so on. And I mean, I know there's huge differences in what you're able to provide, and I know that everybody's under massive pressure, but I do think that is an absolutely key issue, and it's affecting recruitment as well as retention. Because they get negative messages about how much support they get. In some cases, it affects which agency they go to, but in most cases, it probably just puts them off, and that's a major factor. Some of the, if you like, less key findings, they were the three main findings, but some other drivers, certainly more intrinsic initial drivers than extrinsic ones, by which we mean things about essentially what you might call altruistic kind of reasons for wanting to make a difference to the lives of children and so on. The practical side of things, extending the family, providing a sibling, personal experience themselves of being fostered, wanting home-based employment, all those kinds of things. Income generation has been a bit of a thorny point, as you probably know, and debated much in the literature. And Derek Curtin at Kent has done quite a bit of work on this. If you're interested, we can send you the papers. They're very interesting. He argues, as has done some of the other surveys in other countries, that it's rarely the very first reason, although it's always something which is considered further down the line during the process, is either, if I give up work to do this, will I be worse off? Or will I be out of pocket? Or will it help me to make ends meet? Those kinds of things clearly come up during the process, but not usually the very first one. So what we are doing in order to address this now is a new study, which we've debated with the DfE to try and with the, more importantly, with the researchers doing the DfE study to try and complement it. And what we want to do, and we need your help here, is to follow inquiries at the point where somebody inquires. So it's not retrospective, it's prospective. It asks them how they're feeling now, what they're thinking about now. Of course, the big danger of that is that we will influence the process by asking people questions. You know, why are you thinking of changing jobs? You are going to start to, in answering that question, you're going to start to rethink and reflect on things which might then change your subsequent behaviour. So we have to make that explicit. We have to try to come clean on that. We still think it's worth doing it like this. We're looking for local authorities and independent providers who are willing, during February and March, to ask people who inquire whether they're willing to be engaged in some research. We will then get in touch with them if they are willing to be engaged in some research, and it may be a biased sample for that reason. And we will try to establish, we will try to follow them through. At the moment, what we're doing is we've contacted a few local authorities who are interested in this issue and asked them to tell us how many of their, what proportion, local authorities and independent providers, what proportion of their inquiries from 2011 have led to registration, and what's the average time between the two? Because those seem to be quite important. Robbie Gilligan in Dublin, who's coming to do a seminar for us in Oxford in January, has made very clear to me that it's not a good idea just to encourage more and more people. That it's not a good idea to necessarily assume that we would get better workforce in this area, if you want to call it, or foster carer group, by just increasing the proportion who go through to registration, because he feels that that might increase the proportion of people who are not suitable. So actually, we have it's quite a complex set of issues, this. He's in favour of trying to persuade more people to inquire, and then, which of course, unfortunately, increases your work in some, for some of you, massively. Right, I need to stop. So I will just try and speed up on these last few points. So we're looking for people, and we are going to try and follow them through, and we're going to try and interview people who drop out of the process, because we know that there hasn't been much of that. And you specifically mentioned deregistration. We don't know that much about the proportions, I think, who deregister. I'm not sure if you've looked at that specifically, and whether it's through ill health, retirement, or actually that they don't want to do it anymore. just going to mention a couple of other studies here very quickly. We worked on the 5th of December, we trained 10 foster carers, mixed group, from independent and local authorities in interviewing techniques, and they will be involved in that motivation study. We think that will give more authentic responses. I'd be interested in your comments. A bit controversial, that. Second study there, they will also be involved in. We're doing a review at the moment. One of the things that comes through from many studies is that foster carers say that their best source of support is other foster carers. I'm sure you've all heard that. So what we're trying to find out is, what does that mean? What does that look like? What is it they provide? Is it about cups of tea? Is it about understanding the experience that somebody else is going through, which is similar? What is it that they get from that contact? And we want to look at, we're looking at the research evidence on that, of which there is not much. There's a lot about training and the fact that they like the contact with other foster carers when they train, but there's not much specifically focusing on the support. And we will then do an intervention. Again, this is an appeal to you, any independent providers or local authorities that would like to do such an intervention, to get in touch. We would like to do an intervention where we use the review to design something which tries to capitalise, I suppose, on the fact that foster carers get support from one another, tries to actually enhance that in some way. And I won't mention the next one. The final one is looking at children who've been placed separately, and we're negotiating at the moment with a charity called Siblings Together. I've already mentioned that we're trying to engage carers in interviewing, and we've got another 20 applications from people who want to train in January. But we do also we're spending about a third of our time at the moment on consultation. Young people, carers, etc., other organisations, to try and find out what people think needs researching and how it should be done. And there's a list which you'll find on our website of the forthcoming seminars, and you'll see that Robert's speaking alongside Mike Steen and Sonia Jackson on the 20th of March about care leavers, and there's all the things I mentioned about information. So I shall stick some copies of the motivation review out. I'm sorry if I've gone over the time a bit. I think we started a bit late.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from policyreview.tv. For more details, go to www.policyreview.tv. Please note that this audio is subject to copyright and cannot be used by other broadcasters or for commercial gain.